brought to you by Black Knight. It's the technology.ie podcast, episode 31 for May 31st, 2012, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinchon. Hello and welcome to technology.ie, the podcast brought to you by Black Knight. My name is Conor Muinchon. Black Knight CEO Michaela Nealon is on the internet. We reach out over Skype. Michaela, where are you this evening?
Nowhere interesting, I'm afraid. I'm just sitting here in Carlo this evening.
At home this evening. We have a guest this evening. That's Gavin Hanley from Google. What do you do at Google, Gavin?
Hi, Con. Hi, Michaela. Yeah, I'm an advertising strategist at Google.
Sounds interesting. We'll talk more about what you do. And I think Michaela has lots of questions for you for part two of the show. We're also going to talk about some of the tech news this week as well. And don't forget, if you, as a listener to the podcast, want to get in touch with us or leave a comment, you can just do so through the website at technology.ie. And it's all socialised by Michaela and James Larkin as well. You've put all kinds of cool things on it. So if you tweet it, they show up as comments on the blog posts. I really like that, Michaela.
Yeah, it's a nice feature. I mean, you can log in via Twitter, you can post via Facebook. You know, we hook into Google Plus to, you know, plus one stuff. You can send it to LinkedIn. But the common thing is it's pretty interesting because you can actually end up cross-posting your comments. So if you post a comment via the Facebook aspect there, it'll appear on your Facebook wall and also on the blog as a comment.
I like that. That's good. That's the way it should work. But you're a bit annoyed this week, Michaela. You've posted on the Black Knight blog. You're writing opinion pieces for the Sunday newspapers. What's wrong, Michaela?
The world, Con. The world. It's falling apart around us. I know. One of the things that's been, you know, it's been a topic for a long time, and it's something that I think we've touched on several times in the past, is, you know, the internet is no longer a precocious child. I mean, I don't know what the analogy is. I mean, is it a teenager? Is it in its 20s? I mean, we spoke to one of the internet pioneers there last week, talking about some of his experiences in setting up the first networks back in the 80s. The problem now is that there's a lot of crime online. There's a lot of scams. There's a lot of other bad behavior that's going on. And the problem, I suppose, is that government and law enforcement are trying to do something about this. My little rant is that maybe what they're proposing in this area, particularly around domain registration, would basically make us as registrars have to police parts of the internet. And that, to me, is quite an abhorrent concept. And so, I mean, I go into it in quite some detail.
You have an emotive headline on the Black Knight blog, "Don't make us treat our customers like criminals." And you go on in the blog post, Michaela, to explain that, as listeners to this podcast will well know, you travel the world attending meetings of ICANN, Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. Have I got it right?
You did. Very good.
And you go to these international meetings. You point out that as a domain registrar, you have you're one of the few. You're the only one in Ireland, for example, that's accredited with ICANN, which means that you participate in this policy. You see it when proposals are coming up. And what this boils down to really is that agreement with ICANN and the next revision of that. There's lobbying going on from governments and law enforcements to request basically that domain registrars such as yourselves would collect more data than you currently do.
Yeah, and the problem is it's not just a question of collecting data, it's that a lot of the data goes outside what would be needed to actually provide the service. I mean, you know, it is kind of legalistic in some respects, but I mean, we've spoken before about privacy, and privacy, it's a very, very hot topic. So under Irish and European law, there are limits to what you can collect in the way of data. I mean, Gavin, for example, works for Google. Google collects a certain amount of data, but it can't collect more data than it needs. Yeah. And, you know, it's the same with anybody. I mean, even yourself, you know, you're running your own website or in your own business.
Yeah.
You're not going to ask somebody to provide their blood type before you record a podcast.
So let's boil it down to a simple situation. What do you need? You're a domain registrar, Michele. I want to register beesknees.com or something like that. What do you need from me in order to register a domain?
Contact details.
Currently, yeah.
Currently, your contact details for who is, and obviously for us to be able to bill you, and payment.
So what is what is the proposal that's being made here? What would certain elements in law enforcement and government like to see changed there?
Well, what they're doing is they're specifying a whole load of things around validation and verification of the registrant. In other words, the person registering the domain name. And the problem there is that, let's say, for example, taking the Getting Business Online project, it's a very, very good example. A lot of the small businesses that we're targeting with that, and in cooperation with Google, they're companies and small businesses that aren't online. So they're scared of computers. They don't understand the internet. They know it's there. They want to take advantage of it, but they're probably quite cautious, gun shy, whatever way you want to look at it. Now, a lot of them don't even have email addresses at the moment. So what part of this is the idea that you'd be validating and verifying all the contact information related to the registrant, including email addresses. And there's other proposals in there talking about having to do SMS or telephone verification and all this kind of thing, which means, like, okay, let's say if SMS was mandatory, then you're assuming that everybody has a mobile phone. You're also assuming that there's that every single mobile network is connectable, because it's not just a case of me selling domain names in Ireland. We've clients in 120 countries internationally. There are large tracts of the world where there are very few registrars, so it's a lot of us outside of those countries are selling into it. And you know, if you've had some of the conversations with me, you know, where I've landed in a particular country, discover that my mobile phone provider has no contract or agreement with that country, and maybe I can make a phone call, but I won't be able to get any text, and I definitely won't have any data.
Now, you've highlighted in this that, yeah, and you're talking about the phone things is one thing. They want you to verify, or the proposal would be that you as the registrar would verify the email address and the phone number. Now, I imagine the email address isn't too much of a problem, but like you're saying, you're saying that this has to be a phone call made to each one of these, or an SMS, which to each one of these, whenever somebody registers wants to register a domain name, they've got to provide you with a mobile phone number, and you've got to verify that that phone number works. Is it a call or an SMS? It's not clear.
It's not clear. I mean, they've spoken about both. I mean, an SMS. I mean, Google uses it for a lot of their services. I mean, we've even used it for some of ours. But see, the key thing here is that nobody has put a gun to our head when it comes to doing certain things and said, you must do this. You know, we've made that choice. It's a business decision. And if you want to do business with us, you choose to do that on the terms that we've chosen to lay out. If I want to charge you €5 for a domain name or €100 for a domain name, you have the choice. You can choose to go to somebody else. You can choose to pay it. You can choose to do whatever. The problem around a lot of this stuff is if it becomes mandatory, obligatory, and binding, that means that we would be in breach of our contract if we didn't actually do exactly what they're demanding that we do.
What's the rationale for this? How do they think this will make the internet better, safer, more honest?
Well, the problem, of course, is that, you know, domain names can and are used for phishing, for online scams, there are websites set up selling, you know, fake goods, fake pharmaceuticals, a whole range of other things. And, I mean, there's a lot of nasty stuff on the internet. And, you know, domain names can be used for a lot of that stuff. And the problem, of course, is that out of the millions and millions of domain names out there, quite a number of them, the contact details for the domains probably aren't accurate. The providers who are selling the domain names mightn't be that responsive. There's a whole range of issues there. The problem, of course, that from my perspective is that just because somebody could do something something nasty, something evil, doesn't mean that we should assume that they're going to do something evil. Mm. I mean, one person I showed some of these proposals to was about to get married, and he said, "Well, you know, I don't even have that kind of information about my girlfriend." You know, it's you know, it's a very kind of, it's a slippery slope, I suppose, is the thing here. I mean, it's,
so what would you propose, Michele? What would you propose instead of these kind of requirements?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that you can do. I mean, there's certain things that you know, you could ask registrars to do, such as, you know, removing a lot of the rubbish data. Mm. So, for example, if you've got domain names registered with, you know, one, the street, the town, and a bunch of kind of random keystrokes as the telephone number, that kind of thing. I mean, that's low hanging fruit. It's obviously bad data. Mm. I mean, other registries outside the ICANN thing, they don't validate everything. What they do is they work more on overall data quality checks. So is the overall data in good quality? Not is each specific element 100% validated. Mm. But I mean, ultimately, it comes back to a lot of the stuff that we talked about before, about, you know, industry, government, all this. They need to work more together and to kind of improve things for everybody, as opposed to mandating very, very restrictive legislation and terms that have a very negative impact.
What do you make of this, Gavin?
I think it's just very interesting in terms of whether there's an actual choice here. And I suppose giving, you know, registrars the option, you know, if you want to provide more information, that's your choice. But, you know, as Michele said, you know, I suppose not making it, you know, something compulsory. I think choice is important. You know, I'm all for protection online, but at the same time, I think, you know, advertisers, users, registrars, they need to have the choice. The one thing that I'm not quite sure on, and Michele, you might be able to clear it up, is just, is there a kind of thought process here about, you know, who looks after the data that's been stored and the costs involved? And
well, this of course is one of the things that we've all raised. I mean, the kind of attitude that we're getting from certain corners is, you know, we want you to solve this. We don't care how you do it, which isn't exactly helpful in terms of the data storage. That would be up to the registrars to handle. The problem, of course, is that if you look into the contracts, all the terminology refers to retaining data for the life of a domain. See, the problem there is you can register .com for up to 10 years. And once it's reached an expiry of 9, you can add another year. So you can keep adding a year onto it. So that would mean that, let's just say for argument's sake, you were to register a domain name with us tomorrow, then a lot of the data around that transaction, if this were all to go through, we would have to hold on to it for maybe 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
Plus there's also other bits in there about revalidating it on an annual basis. There's stuff about if the validation fails, you should take the domain offline. Mm. The kind of problems here is, let's say for a large corporate, actually Google's a perfectly good example. If you went around the Google offices in Dublin, you won't be able to find the person who's responsible for Google.com. You could wander over to Palo Alto, try the same thing. You won't find them. But there's going to be a valid email address associated with it. It could go to several people, or it could go to a third party. You know, there's all sorts of interesting issues around that. So somebody could get an email in, not know what the hell it was about, and totally ignore it. End result being Google.com is taken offline.
Perish the thought.
Well, it's a very interesting interesting concept.
Michele, isn't it true that certain top level domains, certain types of domain names you register, already have more stringent requirements than others? I'm thinking of .ie, for example. Are the, you know, which is in general more restrictive, you need to have, in some cases, registered business names, proof of identity, depending on the type of .ie domain name you are registering. There's a lot more work in that, and there's often manual work in that. It adds to the cost and trouble, I suppose, associated with having .ie domain names. But On the other hand, Michele, is there not an argument to be made that the public at large can have more faith in such a domain name? We don't generally expect to find, I suppose, bad sites in the .ie top-level domain.
You've been reading too many PR releases, Con.
Have I?
The reality is that a good example of a country code top-level domain would be co.uk, and they have literally millions of domain names registered. Yes, there's, and the quality of the data and all that is pretty good, but they don't put any restrictions in the way of registration. And if you're a private individual, you can opt yourself out of who is, so your personal data isn't going to be displayed to the world. I mean, your name will appear, but that's about it. The problem with .com is that the way it is at the moment, you register a domain name to yourself, all your data ends up in Whois. So, of course, a lot of people are going to put in data that isn't exactly reliable. Now, the funny thing is, of course, they're going to want to pay for their domain name, so they're going to provide their registrar or provider with correct data. I mean, the argument around, you know, building up consumer confidence and everything else does have a certain validity, but the flip side to it is, surely it's in our interest to encourage businesses to go online. And if you look at the data we have from the Getting Business Online project, 62% of users opted for .com because it was faster and was easier, whereas for a .ie they would have had to provide extra data, such as, you know, VAT numbers, company numbers, and everything else. And we'd actually tried to make that as simple as possible. And if you look at, you know, restricted domain extensions, they don't grow particularly fast. I mean, what, there's less than 200,000 .ie domain names. Mm. You know, and is that a good thing? I mean, I would say no.
We'll ask the audience as well, if you want to leave a comment on this. How should we police the internet, and is this a way to do it? Is this perhaps a lot of effort for not very much result? Let us know what you think. You can check out the site at technology.ie. We'll link to Michele's blog post on blog.blacknight.com, and you can read about it this weekend in the Sunday Business Post, is it, Michele?
No, not really. That was something completely unrelated.
Oh, was it? All right. Okay.
No, I've been juggling several balls at one time over the last couple of days. I'm doing something completely unrelated for the Sunday Business Post.
Really? Well, I look forward to opening the paper on Sunday and reading about it. You don't want to give us a hint as to what that's about, no?
It's a bit about, you know, how, you know, government should do more to get indigenous businesses to go online.
It's
a bit about that. I mean, it's, you know, the thing is that one of the problems I see, and I think I've touched on this in the past as well, is that while it's great that we have the Googles and the Amazons and the Facebooks and everything else, you know, we really need to encourage indigenous businesses as well. Mm-hmm. And the other thing as well is a bit about how, you know, a lot of our staff are online. They're on mobile phones. They're very mobile aware. They use Facebook. So quite a few of them use Twitter. Yet a lot of the small businesses who are trying to sell to them, they don't even have websites.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, look forward to that in this week's Sunday Business Post. Let's move on. Next story we have on the agenda for tonight, the story of Eric Simons. Did you see this one, or did you get a chance to read this one? The startup entrepreneur who was on a kind of an incubation program, which was run on campus at AOL's headquarters in Palo Alto. And when the program expired and the money that he had got, the seed capital he had got to help him start his business expired, he discovered that his key card still worked. So he decided to live, and literally live 24 hours a day inside the AOL campus, eating their free food, enjoying access to the gym. He had a selection of couches in out-of-the-way places that weren't patrolled regularly by security, and he used to bed down on those for the night, found himself an empty desk and went to work, and people just thought, there's that hard-working guy. No, I don't know what he's working on. It must be really cool, you know? This can happen. This can happen in large organisations, in big companies, companies, especially big companies with lots of different activities going on. I wonder, has anyone ever been discovered living inside Google's headquarters, European headquarters in Dublin, Gavin?
I don't think so, no. Con. This is a fascinating story. It's absolutely brilliant.
You could do it, though, couldn't you? I mean, you have the food. You have. What have you got there? You've got the food. You've got a large building. You could nearly get away with it, could you?
There's plenty of space, yeah. But the one thing is, though, I know the security guys at work would be pretty quick onto you, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
The one thing I was wondering about in this article was how he had clean clothes.
There was a laundry on site.
Yeah, there's a laundry on site.
There was a laundry on site, that's right. So there was free food, there was the laundry. He said he actually got fit because part of his routine was to get up at 5 and go to the gym, and he just looked like some diligent fitness freak worker who had arrived early. And so he would emerge from the gym at about 8 a.m, I suppose, and go to, or about 7 a.m, and get to his desk and start working earlier, you know. What did you think of it, Michaela?
I thought it was brilliant. We get so many of these fluffy stories about startups, and I mean, it's, a lot of them are just yawn-tastic.
Yeah.
This now, I thought to myself, wow, this guy, I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, you know, he's somebody, he went off, he found a way around it, he'd no money. And when the article goes on to about, you know, how much money he spent, it was like $30 in a month or something.
That's what his expenses were down to, yeah. But I guess, you know, when you are in a large company like that, and if you think of all the facilities that a large company like that can provide, and I know I found it before when I was working, say, in large organizations, particularly working on software development or something like that. You know, you might find yourself working late on a project at night. You'd, you know, go to the canteen or whatever it might be. And you would think to yourself, yeah, you nearly could bed down under your desk for the night. Not very comfortable or not very wise, but it is something. In many cases, especially when you've got a gym on site or something else, that's probably the only thing that's missing is a bed. It looks like that's the only thing this man was missing.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I used to work for Disney in Paris, and I think, you know, you could have hidden out in Disney, I'd say, without too much difficulty, because, I mean, it's a huge, huge space.
Yeah.
Of course, you also had hotels as well, so, you know, there were plenty of options.
Yeah.
But the only thing that was missing there, really, was the laundry facilities, because when I was there, there were no laundry facilities on site for employees. Now, there was pretty much everything else. Maybe there was a laundry.
Yeah.
I don't know, but, I think you could almost do it. You could have done it there. Now, Shea Black Knight, not a hope in hell. We'd notice immediately.
You would, I think.
not a hope in hell. Yeah. Not a hope.
Oh. You've got 30 employees, I think, Michele, or thereabouts. It'd be hard to kind of hide in a situation like this. This man, Eric Simons, he was 19. He was just 2 years out of high school, working on a startup related to education. And interestingly enough, he had his initial 20,000, I think, for while he was on that program. When it finished, it seems he worked for months sleeping in the building there. At AOL's office in Palo Alto. But since then, and I wonder if the notoriety or the publicity has helped, since then he's managed to get himself $500,000 dollars worth of investment and seems to be on his way.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant what he's done with the house. He's actually, he has his own house now, and he's actually decided to try and make money out of it by renting out one of the bedrooms, which is absolutely brilliant.
That he's using Airbnb, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So that's entirely appropriate. Anyway, fair play to him, Eric Simons. That is his that's his startup and the story of the guy who basically lived inside AOL for as long as he could get away with it. Any of you guys tried the Yahoo Access browser?
Not yet.
It's a fully fledged browser apparently available for iOS devices, and has got some surprisingly good reviews this week. It's also available as a plugin or an extension for, I think, Firefox and Chrome. I tried it today and I found that it added some pop-ups and kind of overlays over the web pages I was looking at. Unfortunately, I was looking at I was trying to edit a Google spreadsheet earlier on this evening, and I found I couldn't access I couldn't switch between sheets in the same file because of the Yahoo Access overlay. So I threw it out again. But it's an interesting thing from a company which really hasn't had a lot of good press lately.
Yeah, I mean they've really been cursed. I mean they really have.
But it's a direction thing. It's a feeling that they don't really know where they're going, Michele. And it's interesting then to see them come out with innovative products, isn't it?
Oh yeah, no. I mean the thing about Yahoo that I've always found fascinating was that, you know, they'd plug away at stuff quietly in the background without making a lot of noise, and then they'd release something, you know, pretty cool. But it wouldn't attract the same level of attention as stuff being done by other companies. But at the same time, you look at the figures about the revenues and everything else, it's still bloody impressive.
Yeah. Is it, Con, is it seems very much kind of tablet-based, is it?
Yeah, it's for, I think, iPad and iOS. It's for iOS. It's for tablet and iPhone, I think. And I'm not sure if there's an Android version of it or not. But it seems to be very much designed for that. But if you want to kind of experience the desktop version of it, you can install this plugin for Chrome. But it's interesting we would have thought once upon a time, I think, that the browser had been invented. Nothing new there, and yet we've seen a lot of shake up there. That's another thing I want to refer to this evening as well. Latest data from StatCounter actually on the browser wars, suggesting that it's all there to fight for at the moment with Chrome, with Microsoft, with Yahoo, and with Firefox. Chrome has definitely, the suggestion is, Chrome is definitely coming to the fore. I presume you guys use Chrome in Google.
No.
No?
Of course we do, yeah.
Is it mandated? Do you have to eat your own dog food in Google?
No, it's not mandated. You know, we have the choice to use, but like in terms of just, I suppose, efficiency at work, pretty much we're all on it, and so it makes life an awful lot easier. Mm. But it's not mandated.
So I mean, and would you use, say, and stop me if I'm prying too much, but would you use, say, Google Docs instead of Microsoft Office, that kind of thing?
No, it's a complete mixture. So in terms of docs, I'd use on a daily basis between colleagues. But like I use Excel quite a lot, PowerPoint, of course. I suppose when you step outside of the office, you know, a lot of people are, you know, using Office for PowerPoint and Excel. So I'd use that, yeah, on a daily basis. But in terms of just efficiency at work, I find docs fantastic.
Yeah. We were talking about it before we started the show this evening. We use Google Docs to collaborate on the notes for the show, Michele and I. And I find it for collaboration to be absolutely fantastic. And very often when I'd be working with, say, somebody for the first time, they'd say, you know, let's get to work on something. I'd say, right, let's throw up a Google Doc on this. And they'll say, what on earth is that? And I just share it with them. And I say, well, you use Google. Have you got Gmail? Most people have Gmail and have never discovered Google Docs, I discover.
Well, that's interesting.
It is, yeah. And Gmail has really penetrated, but Google Docs not quite to the same extent. I think Drive is going to change that a little bit, because a lot of people are familiar with things such as Dropbox and things like that when you talk to them. Not so much with Google Docs, but now that Google Docs has this Google Drive element to it, which incidentally I said I wanted to talk about this week, I've been using and I find it absolutely fantastic. Did you install it, Michele, or try it?
Google Drive. I have it installed on one machine. Mm. I haven't really been using it. I mean, I played around, but what I find is that everything with me, it's down to, you know, making sure that I don't have to have too much of a learning curve with it.
Yeah.
So, like, I switched back to the classic view because I didn't really want to spend too much time poking around in a new interface when I only use it for certain things. I mean, with you and with a couple of other people for a couple of other projects.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got a lot of potential. I think, you know, there's like anything, competition is a good thing. I mean, coming back to this discussion we were having briefly there about the browsers, you know, the more competition there is there, the better. Because, you know, as Barry was saying last week, you know, the interface is still terribly boring. It hasn't really changed much in the last 20 years. You know, we've got flashy widgets, we've got Ajax, now we have, you know, HTML5. You'll have something new in a few months' time, probably. But the actual interface itself hasn't changed. And some of these browsers that people are coming up with, primarily for tablets, again, I mean, it's all mobile, they're challenging the interface. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I think we kind of suggested that talking to Barry last week as well, that if anything is going to cause this this shift, I think it is going to be mobile. That is going to literally fundamentally change things. I've linked to an article by on CNET there. I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's kind of in relation to, well, it's in relation to the Facebook phone, which I want to talk about in a minute. But there's an article there by Molly Wood, which I've linked to on CNET, which points out that Facebook is still, as she puts it down at the end, she says in it, Facebook is still the king of the web, and it's a kingdom that's shrinking. Because, and Facebook acknowledged this, it's one of the issues which may be affecting their share price as well, is the fact that they don't monetize mobile. And in the last quarter in particular, they've seen mobile use take a huge jump, a huge chunk out of their use. And right now they have no way to monetize it. It's a real, I suppose, pointer to the importance of mobile, and perhaps a warning for Facebook.
And it's something they're going to have to address really quickly.
Looking like it, yeah.
I mean, several of us have been discussing this over the last few weeks. Like, you know, Facebook releases updates for their iPhone app, and it just gets slower and slower and slower and less responsive, less useful. Whereas if I go to the mobile web interface in Safari on the iPhone, it works a little bit better. But the mobile experience on Facebook isn't exactly stellar. It really isn't.
I think it's one of the reasons that I don't use Facebook as much as perhaps I ought to, is the fact that there isn't a good way to use it on mobile.
Yeah, I mean, I use Twitter on mobile all the time. It doesn't matter where I am. I've got several mobile clients installed, and if I have to, I can use the web interface as well on mobile. And that works really, really well. I mean, Hootsuite is fantastic. I go into certain lists and I look at certain things because, you know, the iPhone battery isn't exactly stellar. Mm. But Facebook, not so much.
And in as much as Twitter monetizes anything, it does it just as well on mobile as it does on the desktop. You see promoted tweets and that show up all the time.
Yeah. So
I think what's interesting on that, Con, is that, like, it's, I suppose, if you think of the actual device and I suppose the simplicity of Twitter is a lot less kind of havoc on the screen in terms of, it's still very much text based. It's very much like, I suppose, sending a, you know, a text, and I think that's why it works well on the device.
But it should be possible to do this for Facebook as well, and several apps have done very well on mobile. And Instagram in particular, this was one of the attractions, I suppose, for Facebook, was the fact that it was a mobile device or a mobile app, and that this was where it was being used. Facebook ought to be able to solve this, and not by spending $1 billion on Instagram either. Turns out they've come out this week, I don't have details about it, but I don't know if either of you two have heard it, they've come out with their own Instagram clone this week, which obviously must have been in the works from before they bought it.
Yeah, Facebook Camera, isn't it?
Is that what they're calling it? Yeah,
it's just an extension, another app for, I suppose, quick uploads of shots, really.
But they really ought to be able to fix this, Michele, shouldn't they?
Well, considering the amount of money they have, you'd think that they would. I mean, you need to monetize mobile. You have to. You have to monetize all the traffic that you have, and, you know, if you can't, that's why they're pushing more of this, what are they calling it, promoted stories or something?
I think so, yeah, on Facebook. But wait a minute, I have an idea, Michele. Let's make a Facebook phone. It's a little bit simplistic maybe, but this is what they're doing, and apparently it's their third attempt to do that. They're all reporting it this week, I think, TechCrunch and others, that Facebook, and I'm not sure if I have a particular link to it handily at the moment, but that Facebook have decided they're going to make a phone, and I'm not sure this is the solution either. What do you think?
It's, you know, leave making phones to phone makers, for God's sake. You know, Google, at least, they provide, they don't try making the devices. They have the Android software, which, you know, is giving iOS a good run for its money. Mm. But actually getting into the device market?
Well, it seems to be it's taking on an awful lot of trouble. You've got to compete in a whole new market. But then again, maybe what they need to do is diversify and go into this kind of an area. Of course, when we first heard about the G phone, the Google phone, as I think it was rumored, or as it used to be called, it didn't really occur to us. We didn't know that it was going to be what Android turned out to be, Gavin, did we?
It's been very quick, you know. It's been such a development in the last few years. But again, I think the difference here really is, I suppose, with Facebook, I suppose what you need your phone for goes far beyond just, you know, the social side of what a phone does. I suppose Android, in a way, I suppose, as Michele said, because it's very much focused on, you know, the operating system behind it, and I know it's, of course, it benefits with what we can do with search. I still think it does answer a lot of the kind of needs of the everyday user, whereas I don't know how I'd feel about having my phone, I suppose, the whole use of being focused on the social element. You know, it's what I think is really interesting about that article by Molly Wood is what she mentions about how Facebook was founded, in terms of, you know, it was created with, I suppose, a laptop or desktop in mind. Mm. And how basically she's saying how, you know, what's next, what's going to be the next Facebook, and how, I suppose, they really need to start considering the mobile user and what a threat, you know, there is on mobile.
She mentions Path in that. Have either of you used that?
Yeah, I've used it.
What do you think?
It's kind of, how can I put it?
I've heard it described as the social network for people you love, in that you can only have 150 friends on it for a start.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I mean, I played around with it, but the problem I found, I mean, you know, we've talked about this in relation to several social networks, is, you know, that unless you've got a certain number of friends sharing content and doing things on a network, it's kind of pointless, and you're not going to bother going back. Mm. I mean, Path, I think I still have it installed on this phone. I also have to check. But I literally haven't logged into it, I'd say, in 3 months. Mm. Because I've no compelling reason to do so. I mean, nobody's sharing any kind of going, hey, check out the latest thing I posted on Path, or whatever. I mean, I'm logging in now, and it's taking its sweet time to do so. My account has been asleep for 2,302 hours. Now, that's like 100 days or something?
That's kind of a quaint way of putting it. What about Google Plus, Michele? How do you find the mobile experience on that?
I don't really use it that much on mobile, to be honest. I mean, when I have used it, it's been grand. I mean, it's actually, it's something they did get right. And I'm not just saying that for Gavin. it works very well on mobile.
And when you say mobile, you mean iPhone, don't you?
Well,
in your case, yeah.
Well, sorry. If you're talking to me, it's an OS. It's an OS 10 iOS Apple device. I don't use anything else.
Yeah. And this is the other thing, as I was saying to you, about the difference in Michele's approach and mine, Gavin, is that I'm very much I use a Mac grudgingly, and I have a. And I'm very fond of Android phones. And one of the things I like with I suppose, is that kind of integration with the Google and Google Plus world that you get on an Android phone. In relation to photos, I love it at the moment is the way you can set your Android phone. Can you do this? I don't know if you can do this with an iPhone, but you can set your Android phone to automatically upload all your photos to an unshared folder on Google Plus.
So it comes in handy when you lose your phone, I can tell you.
What are you using, Gavin, phone-wise?
So I use, it's a Nexus Prime, so it's a Galaxy, Samsung Nexus Prime.
Right.
It's a lovely phone. But like, there's also an iPhone here in the house. So there's various things hanging around. But I think in terms of Google Plus, the one thing about it is that I hear it being often, you know, compared to, you know, Facebook and the whole social element of it, but I think it's also important in terms of how it's integrated with search as well. And I think it's only really getting started with, you know, how it's integrated with a lot of the other products. So it's, I suppose, yet to be seen.
You put a link in, Michele, Facebook supposedly buying face.com for between $80 and $100 million. What's that about?
That is some headline. I mean, you know, we've spoken about high-value domains in the past. I think sex.com or toys.com, I can't remember which one, still holds the record at something like $15 million just for the domain name with no content, nothing else. The face.com thing is a bit different because it's a fully developed business. The domain name was originally bought at an auction a couple of years ago for, I think, maybe a couple of $100,000 or something like that. But it seems that Facebook's in serious talks with the owners. So if you actually go to face.com, you'll find all the information you want about this facial recognition software. And they claim that they're the world's largest and most accurate face recognition platform. Now, there's a couple of things that makes this one interesting. You know, Facebook has been doing a lot of stuff around facial recognition, which has upset people, but also it's something that, you know, a lot of people use. I mean, you upload a load of photos to Facebook, you want to be able to tag your friends and everything else in it. So maybe they're going after the domain name and the technology. Who knows? But it's an interesting one, and you know, it was something that a few of the big domainers picked up on earlier this week, so I thought it was worth mentioning.
It's funny, I suppose, from my point of view, and not being a domainer and not maybe attaching the importance or the interest to domain names, I would find the technology much more interesting than the domain name, but I can see how perhaps both might be interesting. But I think what I would really find more interesting would be, in some ways, I think this is a better acquisition than Instagram, and I'm astonished that it's being suggested that it would be only valued at a tenth of the price.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that leaves me, you know, completely gobsmacked. You know, face.com have really cool technology.
Yeah.
Instagram.
They could have built their own. They did build their own Instagram. In fact, they launched it this week.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. I don't know what Gavin thinks about the entire $1 billion Instagram thing.
I suppose I use Instagram. I really like it. I think, I suppose, maybe they were just buying it for the users, really. I really like the app. Pretty much use it on a daily or at least a weekly basis. I when I heard about the purchase, I imagined it was just, a nice add-on. Because I know, like, I think there's something like 250 million photos uploaded every day. So like, it's a lot of interaction, a lot of kind of sharing going on, and I imagined it was for the users.
You're younger than us, Gavin, aren't you? That might be.
I'm not sure, am I?
You are. I checked your LinkedIn profile. Either A, you're younger than us, or B, you're a very slow learner.
No. Definitely. It's we're just not hip enough, Michele. That's okay. we're used to that. Let's move on. I want to talk to you. I want to get to know you better, Gavin. Find out more about you and what you do in Google Ireland, is it Google Ireland or Google Europe that you work for?
So it is Google Ireland.
Yeah.
Interestingly, this year I started working very much for what is the first Irish online sales team at Google. So we've been there, I suppose Google's been in Dublin for, I think, 7 years now. And it's, you know, it's the headquarters, EU headquarters. But this year I started working on basically a new online sales team there in Dublin. So it's been fantastic to start addressing the Irish market.
Excellent. Well, we're going to ask you some detailed questions about that in a few minutes' time. First, though, Michele, what do you want to talk about this week? What exciting and interesting things are you doing at Black Knight Solutions?
We're always doing exciting and interesting things, but, you know, we'll go back to two that we've been pushing for the last couple of weeks. We're still giving away a 30-day free trial of GoMobi, which is the easy-to-use mobile site builder. So if you want to take your site mobile, build an attractive site that will work on pretty much any mobile device you can throw at it, then GoMobi is the solution for you. You can try it out 30 days. Won't cost you a penny or a cent. And the other one, of course, is .be domain names, which is the country code for Belgium, and we're running a big discount on those, and we'll link to that in the blog post that goes with this show.
Very good. You can find out more about those at technology.ie and, of course, on the blog at blog.blackknight.com.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
You're listening to technology.ie, the podcast brought to you by Black Knight. We've got Black Knight CEO Michele Nealon with us. As always, say hi, Michele.
Hi, Con.
My name is Conor Muinichon, and we are joined this week by our special guest, Gavin Handley of Google Ireland. Gavin, it's great to have you on the show.
Likewise, thanks for inviting me.
You were saying to us, Gavin, you work with the Irish AdWords sales team. Is that the correct description?
That would be correct, yeah. So the Irish online sales team, yeah.
Very good. So what do you do?
So basically, Con, what I'd look after is I work as an advertising strategist. So what that is looking after large Irish advertisers and how they use Google's advertising products, and basically making sure they're getting the best out of them, getting the best return for, you know, their investment.
Is the food as good as they say?
The food is excellent. I have to say, we're spoiled rotten. You know, the food is fantastic, and you know it's a fantastic place to work. We're very lucky to have it, you know, on our doorstep, along with all the other fantastic companies that have joined, I think, you know, over the years.
I've heard people talk about the Google Stone.
Yes, what's the Google Stone? So basically, the idea behind this is that when you first arrive, due to, I suppose, the availability of, you know, free food, and you tend to put on a stone within the first year. But we've a gym there that looks after that.
Right.
That's pretty much it. So I haven't managed to. I've kept in trim over the years. I've heard that quite a lot.
Michele, you wanted to talk about pay per click and AdWords and that.
Well, I mean, it's the thing. I think it's the obvious thing to ask Gavin about. I mean, you know, we see it all the time. A lot of our clients would be using Google AdWords. And, you know, the thing, I suppose, is, you know, if Gavin can share any kind of any simple tips for advertisers.
Yeah, no problem. So one thing, I suppose, is to understand exactly, I suppose, what pay-per-click or search, you know, search engine marketing, what it is. And I suppose, yeah, I can definitely go into, I suppose, what we're seeing at the moment in Ireland. So just to give you a bit of background, so I would have started in Google over 2.5 years ago, and I would have worked for UK advertisers initially. And the UK be very much quite an advanced market in terms of paid search marketing. And it's interesting to see Ireland and where it is at the moment and the acceleration over the last few years. So I can delve into that. But yeah, when I talk about, I suppose, pay-per-click, what I'm referring to is, you know, the sponsored links that you see above and to the side of your search results. I suppose the most important thing when I think back, when I any time I give advice, is understanding what you want to get out of it is most important thing, is having a very clear objective of what you want to get out of, you know, your advertising, your paid search. And secondly to that would be, I suppose, looking at how you're gonna track it and rate it and you know, understand its performance. And that would go back to the idea of having, you know, analytics on your site and also having conversion tracking, so you can measure the return that you're getting out of it. And these are really the fundamentals that I'd you know, always persist with anybody that's starting out or considering, you know, search advertising.
Let's say, for example, okay, I mean, I'm just doing a quick search here for a particular keyword. Now, one of the frustrations I have as a buyer is when, you know, I see ads for websites and I actually go to that site and I can't actually buy anything. I mean, is there a lot more of that in the Irish market than there is in the UK, or is it kind of the same?
To be honest with you, in the UK, I've seen, you know, similar situations, but I suppose it goes down to if you're going to click on that ad, I would hope that that is highlighted in the ad that, you know, buy here now. Or that call to action, the reason why you're going to click on that ad and go to the site is that you can have that expectation of purchasing it. And going back to the idea of an advertiser's objective of using paid search in the first place is that is getting the return out of it. And if like yourself, Michaela, if you've just clicked on an ad and you can't purchase from it, you probably won't go back. I suppose that advertiser isn't getting much value out of it unless it's a brick store that you can call into tomorrow. So I think the important thing about it is that frustration from a customer's point of view will resonate back to the advertiser and they won't see the return out of it.
Right, okay. No, that's a fair point. The other thing, I suppose, is a question we get asked a lot of the time is, you know, how much money should people spend on their advertising? I mean, how much money, what's the kind of minimum monthly investment that a small business starting out, dipping their toes in online, should look at setting aside for pay-per-click?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and it's something that you get every day. I suppose, first of all, it goes back to the idea before, you know, I would advise anybody going into it is do your research. So you can get a good estimation online. We've got free tools about how you can actually estimate what you should be paying. So any of you guys have heard there's a keyword tool. So if you just search for the Google AdWords keyword tool, that's a free tool that allows you look up potential keywords that you want to bid on, and it'll give you estimated cost per clicks and estimated volumes of how many people are searching those keywords on, you know, a monthly basis. And from there, you can build up an idea of, you know, what span of keywords that you want to bid on. And very much, you know, I'd be focusing on, I suppose, what you sell online. I suppose if you start from very basic, if you look at your analytics for what you sell and see what products perform well online, what you know, consumers are used to purchasing and they feel, you know, what your top sellers really. I would start with that, look at the keyword tool, get an idea of potential costs, and you can start from there.
But let's say for example, okay, at the moment I'm looking at searches for beds because it's something kind of fairly innocuous.
Yeah.
Plus I'm in the market for a new bed. I mean, the kind of thing that, you know, again, these are questions that we get. Let's say, for example, if you're selling beds, should you be bidding and trying to get drive traffic on something like bed or beds, or should you be looking at something much more specific and narrow, such as a specific type of bed or a particular brand, or should you even consider something like, I don't know, adding in a place or a material or something like that? I mean, which kind of combinations are important for somebody to look at?
Yeah, so again, it goes back to that objective. If you're trying to drive sales, I'd be very, very specific on what I'm bidding on. And also it goes back to the idea of relevance. So if somebody is searching specifically for a type of bed and a model, if you can provide that user with an exact, you know, an ad for that bed and provide them a good landing page that shows the bed straight away and a price and an easy way for them to convert, that is where you'll get maximum return out of it. And it's simple for the user as well. On more, you know, generic terms, like, you know, bed on its own, you know, I'd always think about the keyword as an audience. So somebody that's searching for bed on their own, like just beds or bedding, I would, you know, it's very generic, and they are probably, you know, higher up in the purchase decision in terms of higher up in the funnel. And they may not have made their mind up. So it's very much, they're probably going on for research and educational. So you wouldn't see the direct return. You wouldn't normally associate somebody searching for bed with somebody who's prepared to buy there and then. So it's understanding, you know, the audience behind the keyword and under and behind the search term. So it goes back to that idea of your objective. If you want to generate, you know, direct sales, I'd be very much focused on very specific keywords. But if you're trying to drive traffic and awareness of your products or your company, you can go broader. But in terms of return and cost, if you go broader, it is more costly, of course. But if you're more specific, you can see very much, you know, better return.
Okay, I mean, but let's just say, for argument's sake, you're a small business, and let's say, I mean, okay, you're just experimenting.
Yeah.
You know, what is the minimum budget you should allow per month? I mean, I know it might be hard to tie you down, but let's just say, is 100 euro a month enough, or should I be setting aside 500, or should I be setting aside 1,000 as an absolute minimum?
Yeah, so it's an easy one to answer. So it depends on the number of searches. So say if you want to bid on the term beds, and you know there's, you know, 200 searches a month on it, and the average CPC on it is, you know, 10 cents.
What's CPC now for people?
So CPC, sorry, is cost per click. So basically we can give you average CPCs or average cost per clicks for keywords that you're prepared to bid on. And that will give you an estimation of the budget that you need to set aside to bid on those searches.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So if you decide that you're going to set aside 100 euro a month and bidding on, say, one keyword, using the keyword tool, you can estimate how many clicks you should assume you could receive. From there, you'd be able to gauge the budget that's required. But to be honest with you, Michele, it very much varies in terms of the budgets, the average budgets that people are using. The one thing about pay-per-click is that you can start off with very little and get a good idea of, you know, users' reaction and customers' reactions to your ads. And you can scale up from a very low base, and it's always, you know, cost per click.
So, Colin, have you done any cost per click stuff in the past?
Never. I've never advertised. I've never never done anything like that. So I find this very interesting. As you speak there, I'm just looking at the Google AdWords keyword tool that you described, Gavin, and it's very, very interesting indeed. Again, I suppose in the sense, it's something I should probably, in the sense of what we offer here are services, and we very much kind of work with word of mouth, and we don't generally do marketing except, I suppose. Well, what we do really is promote ourselves organically. So that is something that kind of, that I find, and that certainly generates a certain amount of business for us, Gavin. And we haven't looked at, so what we do is we produce content, we show up, you know, we blog, we tweet, we post, we get a kind of a word of mouth referrals, and people find us through friends of friends and things like that on social media. We show up in Google searches for terms like podcasting and digital media production and things like that in Ireland. So from that point of view, what I was wondering was, say, for someone who, like myself, who might be considering buying Google ads, you know, How would you measure that versus, I suppose, organic or normal search engine generated traffic?
Yeah, completely. One of the first areas that I'd always look at for an advertiser is looking at their analytics and understanding the keywords that, you know, is triggering visits to the site. And it's hugely important. And we'd always try and analyze, you know, gaps of where, you know, they're not appearing. So, you know, where you have, you know, good strength in terms of organic results, it's fantastic. I suppose it's areas where they can't access. It's searches that, you know, potential customers are making and where their SEO does not, you know, appear, you know, where their organic results do not appear. That's where they can get real value out of paid search.
For one reason or another, there may be simply too many suppliers in a particular field and a generic search for a particular type of keyword. You're never going to get on the front page, but you may manage to do that with an ad, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I suppose one other thing that is important about paid search is that you can be very, very targeted in terms of, you know, the user. You can be very targeted. So you can be very specific in terms of exactly what they type in. It will give you an indication of, yes, this is the type of user that I want to show my ad to. And I think it's also the speed at which you can adjust your ads. So to a certain extent, you know, organic results, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from my understanding, they can take some time to change in terms of, you know, on a monthly basis, whereas you can change an ad overnight, you can change an ad in, you know, a couple of seconds, really. Change your offerings based on, you know, seasonality, based on whatever you want to promote at that time. And I suppose that's the benefit of it.
What kind of mistakes do you see people make in their advertising strategy?
There's a lot of mistakes that you can make. I think the very first, the foundations of going on paid search is really understanding what your objective is. I think a lot of people just get stuck in straight away and don't really think about what they want to achieve with it. So is it a case of, you know, building the awareness of your brand by having your ads appear? Or is it a case that you actually want to drive sales and you've got a distinct profit margin that you want to get out of paid search? And I think the second most important thing is having analytics set up on your site to understand what paid search is doing for the site, and also having conversion tracking. So it's being able to measure the performance and making sure that you're getting your return from it. So with those foundations in place, I think the next thing after that is really there can be quite a people can get quite scared with the amount of information that and the amount of data that can accrue when you're creating search campaigns. And you're adding keywords essentially to an account. You're just suggesting keywords that you want to bid on. And it can go very, as I said, it can go very targeted. And to manage, it can take, you know, a lot of time sometimes to manage it. But there are ways to manage these accounts very quickly. And there's new, I suppose, additions to the accounts now where you can make very, very positive decisions based on, you know, the data that you're getting in the account. So, yeah, I think fear of data is one thing that people have. And I think if you just, you know, spend a bit of time understanding how do you get it to work for you, and there's a lot of good results out of it.
You get out what you put in, I guess.
Completely, yeah. Completely. Like, I'm sure, Michaela, you might have come across this with, you know, getting business online. You know, there's a lot of people are taking, I see, you know, a lot of people taking this is their first kind of foray into online marketing. And it can be quite overwhelming. But, you know, once they spend a bit of time, give it a chance and read up upon it, they're really making it work for themselves.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, this is one of the things that, you know, I've always said to people is, you know, it's aimed at this particular demographic. It's aimed at those people, those businesses that haven't really done anything online. It's not competing with you know, web developers and web designers. And we're seeing some of them. You know, they're upgrading to fully fledged websites. They're going off getting websites designed and developed. I mean, there's a lot of different things that they can do there.
Do they get, with that package, they get so much worth of free ads, do they?
Yeah, they do. They get 100, I think it's 100 euro. I should know the answer.
Yeah, it's 100 euro, yeah.
And what kind of results have you seen with that, Gavin? Have you seen perhaps any of the people who signed up for getting business on, Irish Business Online, come back and say, "Gosh, I want to spend 1,000 euros now. That was so effective." Or is it just a kind of, you know, do they really know what they're doing, or have they really the capacity to assess whether they've got a return on that investment?
Yeah, I think a lot of them have really built up a lot of awareness. I suppose, you know, one of the fundamentals of getting business online is the fact to, you know, allowing businesses to be found online. And a lot of them have built up a lot of awareness of their, you know, their businesses through AdWords and through just having a website in the first place. I think recently there, last month, we had the 10,000 business that went online. He was in the office, and it was great hearing their stories. And like, I have friends who have used it as well, and you know, for very simple kind of businesses, just purely to have a presence and I suppose generate awareness. And it's great to see, but it's amazing. I think like the progression of, I suppose, online and also advertising online in Ireland has been. It's been quite dramatic in the last few years. You know, I think the results from 2011, you know, 20% growth in terms of people using advertising online across all networks. And there's a great appetite there as well. And there's, you know, it's generated a lot of jobs as well. So it's a great area to be in at the moment.
We talked earlier in the show about the growing importance of mobile, the possible threat that could have for Facebook, and I guess possibly for Google as well, and for the people who want to advertise and promote their businesses through Google AdWords. Gavin, what do you see? You know, it's a threat. It's also an opportunity. What do you see as the trends there?
Well, to be honest with you, this is really, it's just been explosive. You know, what we've seen on our side has been, it's been quite dramatic in the last year. So what's very interesting to see is the number of people searching. So, you know, aside from paid advertising, just the purely people using the mobile devices and the amount of users that are searching, like we're seeing about 10 to 15% of all searches now in Ireland are on mobile devices. I reckon that'll be up to at least 20% by the end of the year. I actually read something interesting there about the Eurovision there lately. 38% of all searches around the Eurovision were on mobile at the time of it. I think it's getting to the stage. Like, I know what's happened in Japan, that, you know, mobile searches have actually surpassed desktop, which is quite phenomenal. And I think it's happened once in the UK so far this year, where you're getting the number of users that are, you know, actively searching on mobile is now, you know, reaching desktop. So it's growing at a serious pace.
And of course, you can do so much more with mobile. You can search for things which are, for example, near where your location is, for example.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So basically, with the, I suppose we always look at the mobile as, you know, it's got a couple of senses. You know, it can see things, it can tell you where you are, you know, it can hear you as well. And what that allows you to do in terms of, particularly for any businesses out there, in terms of being found. You know, you can upload your address, so through Google Places, you can put yourself on the map. I suppose you can put as much information up there in terms to make sure your business is being found. If you're taking that to another level where you want to use the likes of, you know, paid search, the targeting can become, you know, unbelievable. So like at the moment, you can target the device based on the operator network. You can, in Ireland, you can target by operator network, you can target by actually the operating system, and down as far as the actual different, I suppose, releases on operating systems. And then you can target by, I suppose, location as well. So you can really pinpoint targeting on mobile at the moment.
So you can do more accurate targeting, like accurate geo-targeting for mobile search than you can for desktop in Ireland?
You would be, yes. Yeah. So basically what you can do is there's a release at the moment called Bid Per Distance. So if I'm wandering, you know, around Dublin and say, for example, I'm interested in, you know, checking out at a car dealership. Based on my searches, dealers can actually bid based on how close I am to their business. So it's, to be honest with you, the capabilities of it, you know, there's new releases on a monthly basis, but it can be very targeted.
Sounds like mobile is at the core of how you're looking at things, and you've certainly got some ideas about how to monetize that, Gavin. Also, Michaela, you've sent me the link just now. We'll post it in with the notes on technology.ie as well. You've recently blogged about this. If you've got a business, make sure it's listed on Google Places.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of these things. I mean, it's just such a no-brainer. I mean, for me, I just see it's just such a no-brainer. And I don't use the Golden Pages. I don't. I mean, every year they insist on delivering a copy to my front door, and every year I shove it into the recycling bin. I don't use it. I can't imagine under any circumstances where I would end up on the Golden Pages website. Mm. But Google Places, I use it all the time, especially when I'm traveling. Like, I was over in New York a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to find a stockist of a particular clothing item. Google Places had the answer. Mm. I wouldn't know where to find the Golden Pages in New York, and I don't think I'd wanted to have.
We've heard, Gavin, of course, in the headlines that Larry Page, of course, took over as CEO, and he told you all it's all got to be about social, or you've got to put social at the core of your goals and your target for the year ahead and that. So mobile is one thing, like you've pointed out, and social is really something that you've been working very hard on in Google as well, with the launch of Google Plus, which with the kind of integration then of Search Plus Your World, isn't it called, the social element to your Google social, to your Google search as well. How can that be monetized, or how can that be used by an advertiser?
I think it's basically bringing in that social element to the advertising. So the ability for users to, I suppose, plus one, so basically on an ad or on a website, users can what's called plus one recommend a site to users that are within their social sphere. And basically what they're looking at is you know, the relevance of these ads are, you know, they're more relevant to you based on recommendations from your friends, family, or whoever you consider to be within what we have circles, so circles of friends. And I suppose they're looking at these ads, what we call the click-through rates. So this is users clicking on the ads. Users are responding better to these ads because they've had this layer of social recommendation. Basically, I'll give you just a very practical example of this, is that if I'm on a website and, you know, I'm looking at, say, a new pair of runners or something like that, and I have the ability to what's called plus one, so let's recommend the page or the recommend the site to, it will be automatically shared with my group of friends. If one of my friends then goes on to Google and just searches for, you know, a pair of runners or something related to it, and there's an organic result for that site, it will show my recommendation in the results. And similar things can happen with the advertising as well. So there's the ability to put that social layer on top of it.
Yeah, but with that plus one recommendation, that's a social thing. That's an organic thing in a way. That's an enhanced ranking or recommendation based on what my friends think. But as an advertiser, Can I buy that social? Can I? Is there a monetization option for our opportunity there for Google? Is there a way for an advertiser to spend their way into social rankings?
No, so it's
or is that even desirable? I guess
I don't think it's desirable because I don't think people would. I suppose we're always trying to put the user first in terms of the choice and basically how it's monetized is basically on our advertising. So you have the ability to plus one an ad, and again it goes back to if we don't provide good results to our users, they're not going to use Google. And that goes to the social layer as well.
So you can plus one ads as well as pages.
You can indeed, yeah.
Okay, I hadn't come across those or I hadn't noticed those, but I'll be definitely looking out for them in the future. These podcasts are getting longer and longer, Michele.
I know, it's terrible.
It's not terrible, it's fun. It's fun, and they're actually getting easier to edit and upload and process then afterwards as well. So it swings and roundabouts. It's about the same amount of work in them either way, but it is always enjoyable. Gavin, I really enjoyed talking to you this week, and thank you for giving us your insight into the world of Google and AdWords in particular on technology.ie.
No problem. Thank you.
That's it from me, Conor Mhuíneach,
and me, Michael Dalen.
Until next week, slán go fóill.